This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
Okay, vibrant conversations. How do we know when biblical stories are conversing with each other? Speak into the mic, please. I'm asking you, yes.
Similar language.
Say again?
Similar language.
Two stories use the same language. Now, let's be careful. Proceed with caution. I have the great privilege of teaching at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, home sweet home, and every once in a while my students, lovely beings that they are, come running up to me with great enthusiasm, wanting to please their teacher, and they say, Judy, look, this story has Vayomer in it, and that story has Vayomer in it. Okay, this is not what I mean. Why not?
We have to
refine the shared language concept. What we're looking for, right? What's the brass ring? We want rare language if we can find it. And it might be a word that is quite common, even sometimes Vayomer, believe it or not. If what? What would we want from it to make it a really outstanding word that would tie it to another story? It's in an odd place, maybe if it's used in a strange way, or if it's repeated very, very frequently in a short amount of space. These are the words that leap off the page. And it's our job as good readers, thank you, who doesn't have this? Thanks. To pay attention, to notice it, and to be drawn in, and to say, why are these two stories, why are they adopting this similar language? What do they have to say about each other? Other than language, what else are we looking for?
Similarity to stories.
Stories. Give me an example. I know you can.
She's my sister.
Oh, okay. There, we don't have to work terribly hard. Two stories where the basic information is almost identical. A patriarch, three times it happens, in fact. A patriarch goes to a foreign locale, feels threatened in some way, claims that his wife is not really his wife, but is really his sister, then the danger increases, and then there is a resolution to the problem. What we have to do is put those stories together and see, well, are they the same? What are they trying to say about each other? And how are we as readers enriched by viewing them in light of one another? Yes?
Sometimes you may have a situation where there's not even necessarily parallel stories, but there's even cosmic stories.
Go ahead.
One may say that something that happened with the Avot, maybe even some indiscretion or disloyalty to Hashem, may have caused the Shivud Mitzrayim.
Right. Okay, so there you're getting a little off track into another interesting phenomenon. What I'm getting at here is more just noticing the language, noticing the themes, and saying, if the biblical text went out of its way to present us with parallel stories, stories that are in many ways parallel, the least we could do is notice it and ask ourselves, what's the payoff? What's the gain by viewing them in light of each other? Just to give you one very brief example, I wrote a book about this. I called it Subversive Sequels in the Bible, How Biblical Stories Mine and Undermine Each Other. And each chapter is a pair of stories that have many similarities in word and in theme. And what I'm doing is connecting the dots. The first chapter happens to be my personal favorite. No, you're not getting that one tonight. Is the stories of Yonah, of Noah and Jonah. Noah and Yonah. And if I just throw this out to you, and this is really by way of introduction, I'm sure you could come up with, what? Lots of things. What do they have in common? Boats and water and
drowning,
right? What else?
Personal mission.
Saving
the world. The world is in danger. A world is in danger because of its sinful behavior. God is threatening to destroy that world, and there's this personal mission of someone who could or could not save them. When we go further, we notice that it's not just those right, the low-hanging fruit. There's more. 40 days and 40 nights, time periods in both of these stories. Lots of animals in both stories, words that they share in common, names like Nineveh and Tarshish. The Yonah. What does Yonah mean? The name of the title character, Jonah, in Hebrew means?
No.
What does that have to do with the story of Noah? Right? The bird that he sends off at the end to see if the world is inhabitable. So my point is, we need to notice these things. the text is calling us to notice those things. Once we do, what's left to us is to ask the so what question. We're going to draw them together, and we're going to see how is our understanding deepened by pulling these stories together. What I want to do with you in the short time that we have this evening is to talk about two stories that I believe are in conversation with each other, and this is not in any way an intuitive match. Noah and Jonah, we would all come up with on our own, just given a minute to think about it. But the Tower of Babel and the midwives in Egypt and the enslavement in Egypt, not so much. But I'm taking it on myself in the short time that we have to make the case to you, but not yet. Let's start by looking at these, and if I could just get a copy, is there an extra one? Yes, it's good to see what you guys are looking at. Okay. And here I want to just make one more methodological point before we get moving, and that is the following. In addition to the words that draw stories together, we have to be very alert to words always. There's another kind of word that is a kind of an invitation in to understand the story, to get beneath the surface and understand it in a more fuller way, and in a way, a kind of, Buber refers to this as a way that is it's inherent to the text. It's not, instead of a tacked-on message that we place on the text, we find through the words in the story messages that emerge from the text itself. And we do that by noticing certain words within one passage that repeat themselves over and over and over again. Now, I'm assuming, this is a room filled with intelligent people, I'm assuming, tell me if I'm wrong, we've all written something at some point in our lives. Yeah? Okay. When we write, we generally try to vary our language, right? There used to be, for the young group here, there used to be a book called The Thesaurus. Now we have electronic devices that take care of that. But if you've been using this same word three times, you don't want to use it again, so you find a synonym, and you keep doing that. You sprinkle your prose with synonyms so that the reader doesn't get bored. In the Bible, we often have the opposite, which is instead of changing the word, the text purposely repeats the same word over and over and over again. Why do you think it might do that instead of varying it? Emphasis, so that it's also kind of an arrow. Come in, come further in, follow the lead of these words, and you will get to deeper understanding of this passage. The German word for this is the Leitwort, a leading or guiding word. In Hebrew, we call it a mila mancha, also meaning a guide. That word, if you find it, you notice it, you follow it, it will guide you. It's kind of like in music. What would be the equivalent? Leitmotif, right? You hear a certain collection of notes, and you follow them, right? You may get lost a little bit in all of the variations and agitations that are going on, but when you come back to ba 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 bum, you say, oh yeah, that's where we were. That's what gives structure to this entire composition. Okay. Ad kan, finished with introductions, let's get to work. Source number one, I'm going to ask you now, because after all, we are in the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies, this is not a one-directional experience, I'm going to ask you now to look at the person next to you and take 5 minutes, read source number one in whatever language is comfortable for you. Now, if we were really studying this text the way it needs to be studied, you would not see words underlined as you will see them here on this page. I've done a lot of the work for you. I would have made you look and find the words in this passage that repeat themselves over and over again. Okay, now the fact that I've underlined them does not mean that you are exempt from all effort. What I'm going to ask you to do, first of all, is read the passage and get your impressions of it. But I want you to pay extra special attention to these words and ask yourselves, assuming that these words are in fact guiding us somewhere, where are they taking us? What story are they telling us? Okay, it's now almost 8. You've got, I'm feeling generous, 7 minutes. Let's go. Please make noise. I'm sorry. Babylonia. Babylonia, which is Iraq, modern day Iraq. Yeah. Are you done? Who's done? Who? The heck is this?
I mean, the people that are really studying the work of the
Okay, everyone, with apologies, I should just keep quiet and let you keep going, but what are we going to do? All right, let's go through the words. I am going to write the words in Hebrew on the board. If you would like, I can write the translation on it. Don't be, I hope these words are not terribly intimidating. I'll translate as we go. First, what words did you find that repeat
themselves?
Hava. Okay. How many times does the word hava, first of all, what does that word hava mean? Come, let us. It's a call to public action. Let's work together. That word, anybody know how many times?
Three
times. That is correct. And in general, the rules of the game are, in order to qualify as a guiding word, you need to appear at least three times. What else? What?
One.
Okay. Echad or achat. Okay, the masculine, right? Here's our Pesach theme. Masculine or feminine. This word in either form together appears four times in this text. What else? Keep in mind, these are nine verses. And these words, kol ha'aretz, meaning all the earth. This phrase appears five times in nine verses. Five times. What else?
Safa.
Good. Safa meaning language. Give us a number. What did it feel like?
No, more.
Can do better.
Five, six.
Five, correct. Okay, what else? Language, ear. Five times. What?
Ear.
Okay, now here comes the first surprise. How many times does this word appear? It does qualify.
Three
times. There is a word that we would have expected to be on this list that doesn't make it. When you give a name to this story, what do we like to call it?
It's
Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babel. But the tower doesn't make it to the list. The city makes it to the list. All right, so this is the first intriguing little tidbit that we get from this exercise, is that if we read this way, it seems that the story is more about a horizontal effort than a vertical one. It's about building a city. What else?
Sham
meaning
there.
And let's combine it with a word that looks just like it. Shem, meaning name. And here I want to take a liberty and add them up, combine them for a grand total of seven. Shem and Sham together. Their name. Yeah. Okay, al pene kol, well, the kol ha'aretz we have, and you're right that several times it's got this al pene, and I want to put that over here, because that's going to serve another function. What else? Good. That the root of that is pe vav tzadi lafutz, and that verb appears three times in this story. What else? Anything else? What?
Banu.
Good. Bana, meaning bet nun hey, meaning? To build, and that also appears three times. Okay, I think you found them all. Now comes the hard part. What does it add up to? If these words are repeating themselves in order to guide us and tell us the real meaning or a real meaning of this story, what story are we getting? What is this about? And keep in mind also that there is something very unusual about this story that even allows us to ask that question. What's funny about the story?
Who's God talking?
Well, yes, that's more specific, but in general,
what is the problem?
What's the problem? We have a story about a crime and a punishment, certainly about a punishment, and it seems, right, inferring from the fact that there is a punishment, it seems there must have been a crime, but it's not so clear what this crime is. So we need our guiding words to help us figure out what's the problem here. All right, so we put all this together, and what do we get? What are we seeing here? Let's go through it. Come, let us. One, all the earth, language, city, there, name, scatter, build.
You said there's a punishment.
Okay, hold that question. We'll see. God's not so happy in this story, so we have to take that into account. Right, so maybe to be more... strictly speaking, God is unhappy. Okay? Something's wrong here. Yeah.
Unity.
Ah, great. So one thing that unites all of these things is the theme of unity And how are they hoping to get to unity? Some of these words like sham, bana, ir, kol haaretz, what's their vehicle to getting to unity? What do they want? What?
Spatial.
Say it again?
Spatial, local.
Spatial, local, physical ingathering, right? Containment. They want to stay in one geographical location, and they believe that if they stay in that one geographical location, somehow their unity will be guaranteed. The language comes in here. They feel that if they speak the same language somehow, right? This safa achat, there's some extreme feeling of unity here, and it has to do with the geographical nature of it. Now, keep in mind, they tell us what their goals are. There are two stated goals here. What are their goals? One is positive and one is negative. What's the positive goal?
They want to build a tower.
Yes. For what purpose, though? They say, v'na'aseh lanu shem. Okay?
Reputation.
We will make a name for ourselves. Reputation. What else might that mean? What? Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. That's not the goal. Maybe it is. I mean, that seems to be a means to a goal. But the na'aseh lanu shem, when they say we want to make a name for ourselves, either they mean, what was the word somebody used?
Reputation.
What else might it mean?
I think identity.
Okay, that's a good one. Yeah?
Immortality.
Immortality, permanence, right? They seem to be looking for something really, really permanent. And somehow this act of building is going to give them that desired result. What's the negative goal that they articulate?
They don't want to be scattered.
Pen-na-futs. We don't want to scatter. We do want to make a name for ourselves. Somehow by staying together, they think that they're going to be, I don't know, safe. They're going to be immortal. They're going to be much stronger if they hold tight. Okay, that's. I think if we look at the guiding words, we get to a conclusion that looks like that. But now we have to get back to your point, which is, I would like to posit that the story, in order for the story to make sense, the people did something wrong. And here, getting back to the words, I would say that the words themselves suggest this by presenting a kind of a series of quid pro quo. How do we give the plural quids pro quo? Quid pro quos? Where is each quid pro quo in this story? And literary in nature. The people say, Hava, come let us what? Build. And God says, Hava ner davinavla. God says, I will meet your hava, I will see your hava and raise you a hava. Right? What else besides hava? They say pen nafuts, lest we scatter. And what happens at the end? Vayafetz. God says, that's what you don't want. That's exactly what you're going to get. And the most stinging irony, ironic use of a literary quid pro quo is they say the na'aseh lanu shem, we will make a name for ourselves, and the end of the story is al ken kara shema bavel. You want a name? Here's your name. Your name is confusion, oblivion, scattering. You want permanence? You want reputation? You want stature? You're going to get exactly the opposite. So God is taking everything they're saying and ironically flipping it upside down and saying you're going to get everything that you don't want. I would infer from that, and I think it's reasonable to say God is not happy. And add to that, how else do we know that God isn't happy? How do we know? What does God do? God stops the project. Mid-project. God doesn't even let them finish it. God says, that's it. I don't like this. I'm stopping it. So they're doing something wrong, but now, if they're doing something wrong...
Could it also be that God just decides, I want to challenge them to the next level? It's easy for them to do it this way. I want to give them a challenge.
It's possible.
And they do it in a different situation.
Okay. Look, I think you would be missing the irony, but yes, lots of things are possible, and I think it is possible to read it this way. And again, you're going to see many people who have interpreted the story, that's how many interpretations you're going to find. I'm presenting this one because I think it accounts for the use of language in the story. by no means, and I should just give you a general disclaimer here, feel very free to reject every single theory that I put out here today. These are some of the thoughts that I had, but there are many, many other interesting and equally valid views on this, as long as you find the support in the text itself. Okay, let us look at Rashi. And Rashi is on your page. This is, in general, this I would say if you did a random test, walk through the streets of Jerusalem and ask any person passing by, what did the people at the Tower of Babel do wrong? What would that passerby, first of all, what's great about Jerusalem is that everybody would have an opinion on this. What would they tell you? Exactly. God, right, we all know where God lives. God lives in the sky. And so they want to build a tower to reach the sky, to pull God's power and take it for themselves. That theory comes from the Midrash. Rashi brings it and makes it much more widespread. Here, if you look at the bottom of the page, on the words Divarim Achadim, right, that the story opens with the words, all the earth was one language, Udivarim Achadim. What do those words mean? These are very ambiguous words. Divarim can mean
things,
words, right? And achadim can mean
a few
or unified or one. It can mean one or many. And Rashi says, divarim achadim means one idea, one counsel, one set of ideas. And what is that idea? Not all depends on God. God had no right to choose for himself the heavens. Let us ascend to the firmament and wage war with him. Okay, this is the very traditional way to look at this. God is feeling that the people are trying to invade God's space, and so God stops them from doing this. Now, before we move on to a different explanation, does anybody want to support Rashi? Are there any details that you saw in your study of this text that would support this? Yeah. Good. Okay.
And
yes.
They're
a good match for God. Good. What else?
There's also if their idea is if you're going to get the sort of this ironic twist, then God, they're saying we want to reach God in the sky. God's saying I'm going to come down.
Fantastic. Right. They're saying we're going to go up as far as we can go until we get to God, and God has to go down just to look at what these people are doing. So you really get the sense that God is laughing at them in a friendly way. Yes.
I mean, they don't really say they're going to go up till they reach God.
What do they say?
They say that we're going to go up and umigdal v'roshov v'shamayim.
Okay, good.
And the top of our tower is going to be in the heavens.
Yes.
But they don't really say. I mean, it could be in the heavens without reaching God. God.
Okay,
no,
yes, fair enough. Yes, that's true. That's true. Rashi is using, however, he's taking exactly that observation. And Rashi's saying, why put that detail in there at all? The Rosho Bashamayim, what do we need that for? It doesn't advance the story unless the story is really about reaching the heavens, which is God's perceived power base. And so Rashi does what he thinks is filling in those little dots and saying, that's really what this is about. But it's a theory, and you're right, it's not there explicitly in the text. And the fact that God is affronted could perhaps support the notion that somehow this was an attempted rebellion against God. The problem with Rashi is that Rashi doesn't account for all of this. And so I want to get back to all of this. Yeah?
Maybe Rashi is saying that as opposed to literally trying to build a tower that will go infinitely to God, that by trying to build a city, instead of taking a more horizontal approach, man is trying to conquer the world and put his name over the world as opposed to God's.
Okay, so that in some way is also, this can still be a challenge to God. Okay, that's a nice way to bridge both. I'm gonna look for a different way to bridge them. I'm going in your direction though. I want everybody to get along well with each other. Okay, I wanna now just cite a 20th century biblical commentator. This unfortunately is not on your page. We'll look in a moment at somebody who says something similar. Umberto Cassuto, really wonderful 20th century Italian exegete, spent the later years of his life in Israel, has a brilliant, fine literary sensibility, reads texts with just exquisite care. And he looks at this story and he says, it's not enough just to look at this story, you have to listen to this story. If you want to know what the story is about, yes, you can add up all the words, but listen to the sounds of the story. And here, just as an example, I'm going to pick up, starting in the second verse. Vayimtzeu vik'a be'eretz shinar vayeshevu sham. Vayomru ish el re'ehu. Hava nilbena levenim v'nisrefa lisrefa. Vatihi lahem halevena le'aven v'hachemar haya lahem lachomer. What are you hearing?
Echoing words.
The sounds, the consonants. Which consonants are you hearing? Shes and s's, right? She sells seashells. The chet, the ch, the levin, the words. And Kasuto takes this and he says, these people's language is tripping all over itself. There is a circumscribed number of sounds that are coming out of this society. And based on the sounds, he understands that, or he believes that this story is really about a kind of dulling, repetitive, not unity, but imposed uniformity. That there is a limited, that language, safa echat, one language means one small set amount of sounds and words that people are free to utter. And by controlling language, you can control thought, and by controlling thought, you can control geography, and by controlling thought and language and geography, you can control behavior. You can control people.
Almost like a cult.
Almost like a cult, almost like a lot of history.
It's Big Brother.
It's Big Brother. It's 1984. It's Newspeak, it's exact, right? And there's so many wonderful examples in 1984 about this, right? If you remove words from the lexicon, people will not be able to have that thought. And if you put a new word in, people have to think in the way that word leads them. It's a kind of mind control by imposing in very subtle but insistent ways, imposing a certain amount of uniformity. Yes. Yes. This is, however, extreme. First of all, it's the repetitive sounds, and if you read, I don't want to take the time now, but if you read through this section, you'll see that it's very consistent and that God, in a sense, mocks, like as is done with words, God does it with language as well. Hava nerda v'navela sham sefatam asher lo yishme'u ish sifat re'ehu. God is doing the same thing. I think it's extreme. And moreover, these words, he says, he points to the words as further support for this. The fact that there's, okay, nine verses with this number of words that repeat themselves is very unusual, right? To be so tightly packed and so repetitive. Kasuto says this is something new, and in some sense the medium is the message, right? The form and the content are one. This kind of enforced dullness is really what the society was all about. That's what they're after. And let me just show you what. Just one second. I want to get to source number three, and then I'll take your question. And we really better. Okay. Get this. Hamik davar. Says the following in the 19th century, and it's hard to believe that he said this in the 19th century because he anticipated so much of history that had not yet happened. I'll just look at, let's just read it in the English. He says, "What we must understand what they were afraid of, and that is that some would leave for another land. This was certainly connected to the devarim achadim among them, as they feared that since not all human thoughts are identical, if some would leave, they might adopt different thoughts. And so they made certain that no one left their enclave. Anyone who deviated from the Devarim Achadim that was among them would be sentenced to burning, as was done with our forefather Abraham. What emerges is that their oneness of speech was an impediment, as they decided to kill anyone who did not think as they did." Okay. some of this stuff is a little wild. What is he talking about? Where's the burning? Very creative. He says, where's he getting the burning from in this story? They say, v'nisrefa l'srefa, let's burn burnings. What they mean is that obviously the materials. But he takes great midrashic license, and he directs us to a midrash that he assumes everyone's familiar with, which is Avraham, the budding monotheist, the little boy who figured out God all by himself, and he was he stood up to the conventional thinking of his day, so much so that he endangered his own life. And what happened as a result of that? Did you want to add something?
Sorry.
What happened as a result? The fiery furnace. The fiery furnace he takes as a symbol of what happens to people who are dissidents. And then he reads it back into our story and says, Nisrefa l'srefa, what are they burning? They're burning dissidents. This is a society that is so tyrannical, that is so constricting in what people are allowed to think and say and do, that anybody who strays from that is going to have their life endangered. Hey, that's the way he reads the story. And I think it's not a coincidence that he chooses Abraham to be the opposite. And the Midrash is filled with this, and it's beautiful. Pitting the people, the tower builders, against Avraham. He is somehow the antithesis. Why would Avraham, of all people, be chosen for this job, to be the antithesis of these tower builders, if it's true that what they're about is destroying the identity of the individual and making everyone conform? Okay, the lech lecha, right? Go off in your own way, toward yourself. What's Avraham's last name other than Avinu? Avraham ha?
Ivri,
the one who all the world is on this side and he's on that side. He is the quintessential iconoclast. He's the other, right? And so here they're taking him and they're saying Avraham is the one who knows how to stand up for himself. And here is a society that's based on the very, very opposite. And there's all these midrashim. The midrash runs wild in this direction. Maybe some of you are familiar with the midrash about the builders who've got bricks in their hand. And they're climbing up the side of the building and they trip and fall and die. And the bricks break. And all the society indulges in great mourning for the broken bricks. Not for the person. Why for the bricks and not for the person? People are interchangeable. They're expendable. Right? But building materials, you know, that's valuable. In a society where all differences are erased, are flattened, and this again, talk about 1984, talk about the Berlin Wall, right? I just visited Berlin last summer. It's shocking that this happened so recently, right? And to look at the Berlin Wall, and there are portions of it where one side of the wall has lots and lots of graffiti, right? Tear down the wall. The other side is completely blank. Why is that? Because you're not allowed to say things or write things on that side of the wall, only on this side of the wall. And in fact, the imagery is so fantastic here. Nitziv, the Hamek Davar, living in the 19th century, says, why is it that the city, if it's about the city, he says, by the way, the city is what their plan was, to build one connected, contiguous city that, and with a wall around it. And Berlin, it's shocking that they actually were able to get away with this for 30 years, right? A wall around a city and keeping the people in, the ideas in, so that they, you know, if they escape, they'll bring terrible ideas. But he says, what was the tower then? If it's all about the city, what's the tower? He said it was a watchtower with a guy at the top, with a guard, with the equivalent of a gun, whatever guns they had, and would shoot people who tried to escape. Unbelievable that this is Nitziv in the 19th century understanding the story of Migdal Babel, saying that it's about a city, but the tower is a detail to help us understand that this is about keeping people locked into a particular location so that all ideas can be controlled. Yes?
So when Abraham's tent is open,
it's the exact opposite. Exact opposite. Abraham's tent is a beautiful image. It's exactly the opposite. Exactly right. Okay, so now I want to get back to a point that you made.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sorry.
What bothers me about this, what you're talking about in terms of the text, is the text seems to go out of its way,
yes,
to be inclusive of all human beings.
Yes.
And so where is the imposition coming from?
I mean, who's imposing what on whom? Everybody seemed to be on the same page.
This reading is saying that from the way that they speak, we can infer that their thought processes and their speech patterns have been limited. From the fact that they emphasize staying in one geographical location, these commentators infer that they could be only in those geographical locations.
I'm asking, who was doing that?
The society is doing it to itself. And you're right. And we have to get back to this question. Notice there are no characters in this story. And I think that is a tremendous support to the notion that this is a society that is trying to build, catch this, the na'aseh lanu shem, they want to build a name for themselves, with no names. There's not a single named character in this story. And so these commentators and these words, and okay, with all due respect, I mean, this commentator, I look at it and I'm pulling all that together and saying, the story is telling us in a very subtle way through the ingenious use of language that this story, there's something wrong here, and the something wrong is telegraphed to us through all this. Okay, again, it's not the only way to read it. It's far from it, but that's my understanding. I want to just get back to something you said before, and then I'll let you say something on your own, a new thing. Although I have to tell you, I'm supposed to finish in 13 minutes, and that's just not going to happen. So maybe I have to just quash your brilliant creativity at this moment and just plow ahead. One thing I want to say is that I want to do what you said, which is somehow to try to find some kind of resolution between Rashi's view that God is affronted and that somehow this is an affront to God, and the notion that what they're doing, it seems that this story is they're doing something against each other. Right? So why is God angry if people are trying to quash the identities of one another? Okay, I'm going to have to just go. I want to give you my theory, and here's my theory. I want to say that one of the great messages of this story is that erasing the differences among people is, by definition, an affront to God. I want to say that both of these theories can coexist peacefully. The theory of Rashi, that this is a rebellion against God, and the theory of Ha'amek Davar and Kesuto, that this is somehow an act of tyranny within the society of people against one another, to control one another. I want to say this in two ways. The first is, there is a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, otherwise known as source number 4, where we are told that God imprinted each person with a stamp of Adam, and no one person is like another. God creates human beings, B'tzelem Elohim, in God's image. God wants people to be unique, each and every one of them, as God is unique. Be like God means be unique. It means don't erase differences between you. It means stand up and be different. I would say that's one way that erasing differences is an affront to God, because it's an affront to God's desire for human beings to be unique. But I want to take it to another level, and here's where I'm going way out on a limb. And that is that I would like to argue that they are rebelling against God by making the divine-human relationship impossible. Okay, now I would like to, at this moment, quote a very wise man who I thought was Rabbi Riskin, but then somebody corrected me and said, no, it was Thomas Jefferson, and I said, I always get those two mixed up. That was one of them who said the following. The term religious coercion is an oxymoron. Why is that true? The term religious coercion is an oxymoron.
Religion
inherently, for religion to be religion, there has to be an autonomous choice to invest religious meaning in an act. Right? If I hold a gun to your head and say, light these Hanukkah candles or I'll shoot you, you'll probably light the candles. But will that be a religious act? No, that will be an act of fear, right? You would have done the right thing. But the idea of a person standing up and saying, I, as an individual, is a prerequisite to becoming a religious person. And here there was a story that's related by Heschel, about the rabbis who went off on a retreat, and the one rabbi who didn't show up for prayers in the morning, and everybody waited, and then they went on without him, and they saw him later in the day, and they said, Rebbe, what happened? We were so worried about you. And he says, a terrible thing. I woke up this morning, and like every other morning, I started to say, Mode ani lefanecha. And he said, and I got stuck on ani. And he said, if I couldn't find the ani, the I, what chance did I have of reaching out to a lifanecha, to reach out to another? Buber writes extensively on this subject, right? The I-thou relationship. People usually focus on the thou part of his I-thou, but he also emphasizes the I part, that in human relationships, as well as in human-divine relationships, a healthy relationship, a real relationship, starts with a person who has a sense of self, not expecting the other person somehow to make you whole or make you a person. And here he says, in this story, in order for people to stand up and say, if they can't stand up and say I, then there is no possibility of any kind of a relationship with God, and therefore God in this story is affronted. And I want to get back to what Marcia was getting at earlier, the notion of a story without names. We have an effort, and I think it's a beautiful thing. What comes right before this story? Anybody know? Immediately before it. This is chapter 11 of the book of Bereshit. Right before it, we have the story of Noach followed by something else. There's something in between. Genealogies. Ele toldot. These are the genealogies. And we've got name after name after name after name. And all of a sudden, we come to a screeching halt, and we've got a story that is about a bunch of people with no names who say, v'na'aseh lanu shem. We want to make a name for ourselves by removing the names of the individual. And the end of this story is a resounding no. You can't do that. If you try that, the only name you're going to get is Bavel, is scattering, is oblivion. And what's great is that immediately after this, not on your page, but you'll have to take my word for this. The next verse after our story, Ele toldot Shem, Shem ben me'at shana. The text kind of dusts itself off and says, where were we before we were so rudely interrupted? Ah, yes, genealogies. We're going to get back to those genealogies, getting back to naming people, and not just any people, but we're going to start with a man whose name is
Shem.
Name. Shame, shame, shame. And those, there are then 10 generations that are listed in immediate succession, culminating, anybody know? Where does it go? Abraham, to Abraham, the man who is going to call in God's name, and God is going to call in his name. He's going to be the symbol, again, the anti-Bavel symbol. He's going to be basically the undoing. Okay. No questions, let's go. I will be very happy to stay here afterwards and entertain all kinds of questions, but I'm afraid that Erica is... Wait, turn that off. She's going to yell at me. Okay. Okay, no, I promised you a parallel story, and I really, really need to deliver it in very, very... Okay, let's take a look now in source number 5. And this is the first... chapter of the book of Shemot, and the story of the enslavement in Egypt. And here I want to point out certain words that are borrowed from the story that we just read. First of all, the Ele Shemot B'nei Yisrael, the book of names. Now, there's an irony here because it starts with names, and like in our story here, it starts with genealogies and then the names disappear. In this story as well, all of a sudden the book of names kind of morphs into a book of the nameless. We start with a listing of all of the tribes, and then if you take a look in verse 7, Uvinei Yisrael, they become this kind of amorphous mass where we no longer have the individuals in the story. So one connection between the two is the names. You know what? Take a quick look at it. Just give a quick skim. Time be damned. And see if you can see anything else from the story that we just read in source number 5. Take 3 minutes. Take a look. Let's live on the wild side. Come on your own. Okay, you found it. Hava And as in the story of the Bavel, this didn't make it to our list of guiding words, but Hava went together with Pen. Come let us build, lest we scatter. Here we also have Paro saying, Hava nitchakma, let's deal wisely, Pen yirbeh. Would you believe that there are only two places in the entire Bible where we have this word combination? Guess what those two places are. Okay, there's another word combination that appears in only these two stories. It didn't make it to our list, but these are unusual words. Chomer Livenim, also only in two stories, the story of Bavel and this one. Okay, in addition, we have the building of cities in order to suppress the people. And there is a great deal of support for the notion that what Paro is trying to do here is to suppress the value of the individual Israelite. How does he do this? Just to give you a couple of quick examples of it. In verse number 8, I'll read it in the Hebrew. Vayakom melech chadash al Mitzrayim asher lo yada et Yosef. First of all, how dubious is this? He doesn't know Yosef. How is that even possible? Vayomer el amo, hine am b'nei Yisrael rav ve'atzum mimenu. He said to his nation, behold, the nation of the children of Israel is great and mighty mimenu. Greater, how would you translate that? Rav ve'atzum mimenu. Greater and mightier than we are. Now that is ridiculous, right? They can't possibly be greater and mightier than the Egyptians. So either it's just, you know, outrageous propaganda, just scare tactics, or, and here I have to quote some of our very bright Pardes students who year after year see in this, if you read it hyper-literally, you can read it as Rav ve'atzum mimenu. They are great and mighty, mimenu, from us, right? This is a classic racist argument of parasitism, right? They gain strength at our expense. They are rav ve'atzum by taking our otzma, by taking our power, right? And so there are arguments, there are subtleties, there are all kinds of hints here that the people are being put down. In one of the most outstanding pieces here is the fact that the Egyptians are consistently referred to in the plural, whereas the Hebrews are referred to in the singular. Hava nitchakma lo. This sense that they are right, this monolith. We are of this great plurality of people with all kinds of thoughts and dreams and differences, and they are this one indistinguishable mass. There's this sense of suppressing the people, making them build cities. Nahum Sarna, the great 20th century scholar, writes about Egyptian society here as taking away, making people wear uniforms, taking away their names, giving them numbers in place of names, basically saying this was a society that erased all differences between people, and that was their method of enslavement. And I think it's fascinating that the language here is borrowed from that blueprint to say the way you put down a people is by taking away the sense of the individual. Okay, in this story, we are speeding right along. Here is where I would like to argue that there is a subversive sequel on the way. Okay, I named this book Subversive Sequels because I think it's really cool. What happens is that stories echo each other. They borrow each other's language and themes, not just to reinforce each other. Sometimes they do that. Sometimes a story will come along and challenge the first one and even overturn it. The first story, this one, ended very badly. The people are scattered. The building effort is thwarted. The structure, in a sense, maybe metaphorically, comes tumbling down. Here in this story, in the story of the Israelites in Egypt, we have a structure of another kind. That structure, they come into Egypt, ish uveto. That's at the very beginning of the story. A man and his household. We've got this house of Israel. And I would argue that house is under threat of destruction. That's the structure we have to worry about here. Okay? Now let's see what happens. The question I think that's raised here, can this structure be saved in time? And in the story, we have two figures who don't wait until things are so desperate that the building is going to be destroyed. Who are the two figures going to be?
Schindler.
Yes, they are. And if we fast forward here to verse 15, Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim, here we have a story that started to be a story of named people, turns into a story of nameless people, but the names come back. Vayomer Melech Mitzrayim la miyaldot ha'ivriyot, asher shem ha'achat shifra, v'shem ha'shenit pu'ah. Now, we could argue we didn't need the names of these women. We never met them before, and we're never going to meet them again. But the text is insistent on giving us their names, and I would argue that the reason for that is because these are people who are going to live up to the idea of being named. They're going to stand up for themselves. And in a society that is putting down another people, they are going to stand up and say, we protest. They're going to find the individual power, the power of the individual, to stand up to power and to reverse the direction of the events. In the next verse, right here, the king of Egypt says this to them. He says, he gives them an order. Uri'iten al ha'ovnayim. You will see the Hebrew babies on the birthing stools. He tells them what to see, and he says, if it's a boy, kill the boy, and if it's a girl, let her live. Okay, we'll try to figure out what that means. But notice, they, instead of seeing as they are told, the verb that we get instead is vatir'ena hamiyaldot et ha'elohim. It's a perfect anagram here. The letters are scrambled. You don't tell me what to see. We'll see the way that we decide to see. And what we see is God. We fear God. And this is doubly remarkable because in this story where the individual has been eroded, God has not appeared at all. God has not made an appearance yet. God enters this story, I would argue, basically when these women of name stand up and pull God into the story. Vatir'ena hamiyaldot et ha'elohim, and all of a sudden God comes in. Right? They're the force behind God's entrance. The king of Egypt is named Paro. Paro is not his name. What's his name? It might have been Charlie for all we know. What is Paro? It's his title. It means the great house. I was scribbling one day because I don't know. I know this is a little weird to be scribbling biblical words, but I do that. Paro, and I noticed something quite interesting. That if you line up, oh no, yeah, okay. If you line up Shifra and Pu'ah, and put that against the name Paro, what you notice is, it's basically all the letters of the name. These women have names. Paro does not have names. They are his equal, and I think that's what the letters are trying to show us. But at the end of the day, they're actually his superiors. Their moral force, their ability to say, I protest, is what wins the day. They are called Mialdot Ha-Ivriot. How do we understand that? How would you translate that? The Hebrew midwives. Mialdot means midwives. There's a raging debate going on out there. Are they Hebrew midwives? Are they Egyptian midwives of the Hebrews? And there's arguments on both sides. I would like to suggest the text is not interested in their ethnic origin. It's Ivriot. Ivri is an adjective. They, like Avraham, was Avraham Ha-Ivri. He's the other. These women are by their essence. In their essence, they are Ivri. They are other. They are the people. They are the new Avraham figures in this story who are able to stand up and say that is not, we're not going to allow that. All right, this story is going to be basically what I'm arguing is the undoing of the story of Babel. These women, by virtue of their moral abilities, their moral power, are able to step into the story, and they're able to bring individuality into the story. Individuality brings God into the story, and ultimately, they are going to save the house from crumbling. And if you notice, in verse 21, Vayihi ki yar'u hamiyaldot et ha'elohim, as a result of the midwives fearing God, vayas lahem batim. And there's ambiguities all over the place. Who made them and what are these houses? But if you tie this to the beginning of the story, where they come in ish uveto, this is the perfect ending. It's a ring composition to the whole, to the story. The house is in danger of being, it comes in intact, it's in danger of being taken apart because the individuals are going to be lost. And these women, by virtue of their standing up as individuals, are able to save the house. Vayas lahem batim, those houses are reconstructed and they're able to save the people. I'm going to end, really, because I'm really going to get in trouble, by reading from one of my favorite books. The Egypt narrative helps interpret it more, its more cryptic parallel, the story of the builders in Babel. Both emerge as chronicles of oppressively collective societies. But then, unexpectedly, two characters break the harmonious rhythms of the parallel. Instead of falling into their neatly laid out positions, they appropriate the narrative and allow for a new story, one in which individual acts of defiance lead to a relationship with God and to the redemption of an entire people. While the builders at Babel saw their efforts end in ruin and rubble, the story of the midwives concludes with the reconstruction of the broken household of Israel. The outstanding women of Exodus undermine the Babel narrative to such an extent that in their story, the only structure to come crashing down is the textual account of uniformity, oppression, and godlessness. Good evening.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.